Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, January, how did I forget the date? The 20th, right? 21st, thank you, Rhonda. We have a big guest this hour who's written a very important book, Julian Zelizer. He's been with us many times before. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books. The one we're talking about, which covers a lot of territory, is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. And he covers administrations. Well, actually, he even talks about George Washington and Teddy Roosevelt and McKinley and Woodrow Wilson. The book covers the issue of national security, which he says is nothing new. Partisan fighting has always shaped American foreign policy, and the issue of national security has always been a part of our domestic conflicts. So it's a look at all of these administrations, partisan bickering, what was happening in the world, how presidents responded to that when we were believed in multilateralism, unilateralism, and it covers all of the administrations in quite a bit of depth. Professor Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, author of On Capitol Hill and Taxing America. He has contributed many articles to CNN.com, where you can read him regularly, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, American Prospect, the Daily Beast, Newsweek, and Politico. And he's very well spoken and very smart. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you are would like to send us an email, you can do that. That is talk@wpr.org. Professor Julian Zelizer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is a huge book. You cover so much. It should be, you know, basic history book for people, don't you think?
Well, I hope so. I really wanted to show how politics has never stopped at the water's edge and to shatter that myth once and for all. So I tried to cover as much as possible, mm-hmm. especially since the Cold War, to show how that just wasn't the case.
Right. Let's talk about before the Cold War, though, because you do start the book with the most important national security address and an incredibly important address to FDR. He made it to the country on December 29th of 1940. Can you talk about that particular address and how parts of that really have stayed with us since then?
Yeah, that was an important speech that FDR makes, December 29th, 1940, and it's where he introduces this concept of an arsenal for democracy. It's a time when many Americans were not prepared to go into World War II. Quasi-isolationist sentiment was very strong, and Congress had imposed limits on the executive branch. But FDR realizes we are going to war. He sees the threat in Japan. He sees the threat in Nazi Germany, and he makes this speech, a really dramatic speech, where he says that we need to start mobilizing for war, and we need to prepare for war, and we need to be strong enough, because if we're not, we will end up facing war regardless. And it's a speech that, you know, a large part of the nation listens to. They hear it in other parts of the world. And it's kind of seen as a turning point where it articulates the reason America cannot remain free from the war that was just devastating the world. And it's important kind of ideologically, but also politically. What he's doing is building support for everything from the draft to producing the weapons that would be needed.
Hmm. And before World War II, you write, please explain this, Americans had never created a permanent national security state?
Yeah, every time we went to war a lot. I mean, the idea that we didn't go to war before the 20th century is not true. And we were constantly at war and some kinds of military entanglements. But what we did is we would put together a military system when we went to war, like during World War I. And we dismantle a lot of it as soon as the war ended. There was a resistance in this country to the idea that we should permanently be on wartime footing, that we should have things like a draft or, you know, people in the Washington who are permanently responsible for dealing with national security issues. This country was not comfortable with that. So it was an ad hoc kind of way to deal with national security. We built things up and we took them apart.
You talk about the amount of money that we spent on the military, and it was so minuscule for so many years.
Absolutely. There's great studies kind of comparing what the U.S. spent on and everything from the Navy in the late 19th century to the Army itself. And relative to other countries comparable to us, it was very low. Again, the comparison is pretty dramatic in showing how before the Cold War, World War II and the Cold War, we just weren't ready to permanently be on wartime footing.
If we were squeamish about going to war, how is it that we got involved? I want you to talk about Teddy Roosevelt for a while here, how we got involved in this horrendous event in the Philippines, how we got involved in Cuba, those particular issues. You'd think that they would have created quite an uproar.
Well, they do at the time. Again, you know, the real you see the change starting to happen in what we call the progressive era, the turn of the 20th century. McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt are very important with the war. Roosevelt is part of a group of Republicans who, at the turn of the 20th century, are arguing America did have to do more, that we couldn't use this ad hoc approach to the military. TR, for example, said we needed to create a stronger navy, because if we wanted to be a strong empires needed navy. TR had a vision that America could be a dominant player in the world and use its force, military and economic force, to shape world affairs. And the Spanish-American War is extremely important to starting to use that kind of military muscle and to kind of giving way to these arguments. But in the end, you know, again, we dismantle a lot of what's put into place then. It's still kind of war on the cheap. And again, going through World War I, you could see the changes under TR are not permanent in the way the changes under Truman would be.
Mm-hmm. And was there a tinge of racism, do you think, in that sort of American exceptionalism? It wasn't just Teddy Roosevelt who may have believed in that. Was that a force? I'm interested in your talking about the issue of race because it plays into national security in many ways.
Absolutely. I mean, in this period, in TR's period, we've seen how race was very closely intertwined with some of the ideas of American empire, meaning the arguments about why should America get involved in a place like the Philippines. Part of the argument was it was about racial superiority, that we could civilize people in these countries, that U.S. influence would actually improve who they were. And there was a notion of kind of racial and ethnic inferiority in a lot of these conflicts. And TR, if you read a lot of the material from the period, it's not very subtle. It's an explicit justification for why the U.S. needed to be involved. Some of those arguments would continue well into the 20th century, but you could see them front and center during the progressive era.
Mm-hmm. So this move toward national security, the agencies that we have now, the incredible military-industrial complex starts getting set in place with World War II?
Yes, World War II and the early Cold War. So between 1941 and 1948-49, that is the period when a lot of the apparatus we still have today is put into place. During World War II, for example, shortly before we go to war, we create a permanent draft, which we would have until 1973. We start to have a mass income tax to pay for a lot of this. We start funding, you know, the development of a huge Navy, Army, and then Air Force that is pretty dramatic, the change that takes place between the 1930s and the 50s. And under Truman, you have the creation of the CIA, the National Security Council, and other institutions, which remain important in the war on terrorism. So it's during a relatively, you know, under 10-year period where a lot of this is created, both with the crisis of fascism and then with the threat of communism.
Mm-hmm. And during that time, you've got the Communist Revolution in China, where communism wins, and then you have this huge, you know, attack on Dean Acheson. You've got the Red Scare thing that goes on. Joe McCarthy from our state taking on this issue. Tell me about how that happened and how both parties responded to that, and essentially the Republicans taking up the mantle of anti-communism and leading a charge of communists in our government.
That's a huge kind of moment in the politics of national security. You know, after World War II, Democrats were pretty triumphant on national security. FDR had won a very decisive war. He had led the mobilization to World War II against many Republicans, while Republicans were opposing the war. And Democrats came out of that war, World War II, in, you know, a very strong political position. They were the ones we trusted on national security, not the Republicans. some Republicans are unwilling to see that issue. And in 1949, they get their first opening to really attack the Democrats, and it's when China falls to communism. And a group of Republicans like Richard Nixon and others, William Noland of California, a senator, they argue that, you know, because of what Truman did, because he was not willing to support the Chinese nationalists, that was why communism succeeded. And that was evidence that Democrats, in fact, were not the ones to trust on national security. They were weak on defense, an argument we hear today. So the fall of China is huge, then followed by Korea, where Truman, you know, the war ends up in a stalemate by 1952. And in the 1952 campaign, Republicans run on the themes of Korea, that Truman isn't doing well there, anti-communism, that's the McCarthyite argument, that the U.S. is not fighting communism here in the United States, in places like the State Department, and finally, corruption. And Republicans win the White House, they win Congress, and all of a sudden, this kind of opens up the political battle over which party's better on national security.
Mm-hmm. And it also goes way off board, doesn't it? I mean, way beyond what it should have with the anti-communism that takes hold of this government.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we think the battles are fierce today. You just have to read back in the 1940s and 50s to see how far politicians were willing to take this issue. You know, Joe McCarthy, the senator from Wisconsin, is charging essentially that, you know, members of the State Department are involved in treason, that there are communist agents in the State Department, and he's arguing Truman's really not doing anything about it. And it wasn't just McCarthy making this argument. There were many Republicans at the time who are using this, again, as a wedge to win back some of the support that the party had lost over the past decade. And they attack even the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, in 1950, kind of using him as the epitome of what's going wrong under the Truman administration. Absolutely vicious kind of rhetoric.
Really vicious.
On the floor.
Yeah. And tell me, Professor Zelizer, how it is that Truman gets us into Korea. He doesn't get congressional approval for this, does he?
No, he doesn't. It's in 1950, in the summer of 1950, with the North Korean invasion of South Korea, and the administration and congressional Democrats decide that we don't need a declaration of war to send troops. So he uses executive power to deploy troops into that conflict. And since then, that's actually become the method through which presidents send troops, not through declarations of war, which we used in World War II and World War I, but through using presidential power to make that decision. And you know, that becomes the precedent in the decades to come of why presidents don't need an actual declaration from Congress. They just ask for their support. And again, many congressional Democrats were fine with that. They were behind this invasion, and they were fine not having to take that vote themselves.
Mm-hmm. But subsequently, it's been the case in other wars, in Vietnam and in Iraq, certainly, that people have said, wait a second, this is not an approved war.
Yes, I mean, it's a major source of contention that we gave away too much power to the president to make these kinds of decisions and gave away too much congressional power. And so the kind of cost of going to war, the ease within which presidents can send troops, is too great. And we've created really a bad precedent. There are some scholars like a guy named Lou Fisher from the Congressional Research Service who argues, you know, we've moved to a kind of monarchical government because we don't seek that constitutional congressional approval for these efforts. But but Korea was the way in which this precedent was really set.
And do you think that it will be changed, that constitutional approval in the future? It seems the more minds who are deliberating whether or not we go to war, the better.
Yes, but it's very hard to take back power once you've given it. And there's been several wars where this issue comes up. During Vietnam, the issue comes up of why Johnson was able to kind of, you know, get us involved in this huge operation, really through a congressional resolution in 1964. Comes up in the first Gulf War in 1990. Some congressional Democrats actually sue in court, saying the way we deployed troops was unconstitutional. They lose. And presidents, even when they campaign, like our current president, on the promise of kind of consulting with Congress, in the end, they often try to avoid the politics by basically going around Congress. So it's an ongoing battle. Congress finds other ways to influence policy, and presidents learn that. But I'm not sure we're going to reverse it. It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. So executive power also a basis for Obama's decision to add many more troops to Afghanistan.
Absolutely. He followed a pattern that in some ways he campaigned against. And we've seen that many times. And again, that's why you're suspect to think there'll be much change, even though there are constantly many Americans who say this is not a good way to send our men and women into dangerous situations.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Julian Zelizer. I hope that some of you have had a chance to read his very important book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour. His book is out, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he has joined us on many previous programs to talk about all kinds of different issues. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And while Rhonda's taking a call, we'll get those calls on hold and get to you on the air in just one moment. Let's talk about what happens, Professor Zelizer, with domestic legislation. And Lyndon Johnson, before he got heavily involved and had to leave the office, was able to accomplish some significant domestic legislation, at least before he significantly escalated the war in Vietnam. Once we've got, as this president does, a war in Afghanistan, a war in Iraq, once you've got World War II going on or the Korean War, does it make domestic legislation difficult to do? Does it take over?
It can very easily. Two quasi-tragic figures are both Harry Truman, but much more so Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson, we often forget, in 1964 and 65, is really becoming a transformative president. He's passing sweeping social legislation, which today seems almost impossible. Civil rights,
right.
Medicare, immigration reform, education policy, and much more. And even tax cuts. But slowly, the war that he starts in 64 and 65, which he accelerates in those years, will overtake him politically. Johnson, ironically, when the war is really accelerating in 64, one of the reasons he's scared of withdrawing is he tells his colleagues, who are saying to him, don't do this. He's saying politically, it would be devastating if he's seen as weak on defense, if he starts withdrawing troops from that region. And his political fears help push him deeper into the war. And the irony is that by 66 and 67, the war destroys him in ways that, much worse than not going into the war would have to begin with. And it's very hard for him to build political support for domestic legislation by the time of the midterm elections. And the war, in terms of the budget, in terms of the politics, consumes all of his attention by 1967. So one of the greatest domestic policymakers is overtaken by the war, and it's not hard for that to happen.
Right. Let's go to Craig from Heartland. Hi, Craig.
Hi. Thanks, Kathleen. I was wondering, today they said the Supreme Court ruled that corporations can put as much money as they want into elections without any kind of strings attached. I wonder how that's going to affect our political process. Thank you.
Well, it's a good question. It has relations to national security, and it doesn't, but obviously corporate influence has been a huge issue. Again, President Obama raised it on the campaign trail. It's a fundamental question in American politics, is campaign finance and lobbying. There is an argument that in the end, you won't get huge sea changes in public policy from domestic policy to national security policy if lobbyists are continually as powerful as they are and corporations can give this kind of cash. And unless you change the rules of the game, you won't have big innovation. So healthcare ultimately is watered down because all these interests are able to really lean on legislators. National security, you're not going to have huge shifts one way or another in defense spending because contractors are very influential in Washington. So I think, you know, this always, whenever campaign finance decisions come up or the issue comes up in politics, it brings us back to a somewhat cynical kind of look at the politics and promise of change.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Craig. Marilyn is next from Cleveland. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm interested in your guest comment or reaction to Colin Powell's quote, "Beware of the terrorism industrial complex," unquote.
I haven't actually heard him say that. That's very interesting. It obviously plays off a famous speech by Dwight Eisenhower. When he ended his presidency, he gave a farewell address where he warned of a military-industrial complex in the United States that was going to threaten our democracy. One of the things we forget about Eisenhower, to go back a moment, is that he spent the second half of his presidency, Eisenhower, a Republican, a military hero, railing against defense spending and saying that we were spending too much on the Cold War and we were spending too much on weapon systems we didn't need. And the defense contractors, through their connections to Congress, were playing too big a role in American politics. And he literally ends his presidency frustrated with the Democratic Congress for spending too much on defense and thinking it's just getting out of control. He used to argue that we were, in fact, going to subvert what we were fighting for in the Cold War by building these huge national security institutions and spending so much on defense. I haven't heard Powell's comment, but if he made that and it builds on that speech, I think it is a fear that even many Republicans still share, and certainly many Democrats, that kind of we've built up a national security system post 9/11, which becomes hard to control. It overtakes the politicians themselves, and we have to spend on it. We can't, you know, restore civil liberties because the institutions are in place. So I think it continues through since the Cold War.
And part of it is we got hoodwinked because the Soviet Union didn't have nearly what we thought they did, right?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, Eisenhower actually knows this. In the late 50s, Democrats, before Kennedy's 60 campaign, they were attacking Eisenhower in the late 50s, Senate Democrats, people like Stuart Symington of Missouri and Henry Scoop Jackson of Washington. And they're saying Eisenhower is so concerned with balancing budgets that he's not spending enough on missile systems and that we're falling behind the Soviet Union. Eisenhower knew through secret surveillance photos this was not true. But he couldn't say anything because he didn't want to reveal the surveillance program, and he's frustrated with this. And Kennedy runs on this in 1960 against Nixon, who had been the vice president for Eisenhower. And he argues there's a missile gap where we're falling behind. But it wasn't true. Wasn't true. The Soviets were not ahead of us. And I think some people are concerned about the truthfulness, so to speak, of current claims and wanting to get a sense of what's real and what's not.
Hmm. And did Kennedy know the same thing that Eisenhower did? Did he know about those surveillance programs?
Kennedy said no. You know, Kennedy later claimed that the best evidence he had from the Senate hearing showed that was true, and he doesn't learn it until 1961 and 62 when he's in office and has all the details. So that was always Kennedy's claim, although as soon as he becomes president, there is an admission through McNamara that that missile gap was not true.
Hmm. So that appeal, Kennedy's appeal on national security, was based on blowing up this missile gap. You know, we need to beware of the Soviet Union. We got to be careful of having them get ahead of us.
He starts that way. I mean, his campaign in 1960 is quite hawkish. It's not all hawkish. He is calling for more diplomacy and trying to ease tensions, but he is still a Cold War hawk. I mean, one of his major arguments is that Eisenhower was weak on defense, that we're not spending enough on our military systems, that he, in fact, and Democrats would be stronger in the Cold War, building on the tradition of FDR, than Republicans ever would. But during the course of his presidency, I look in the book at how he changes quite dramatically, mm-hmm. especially in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when he kind of moves far away from that kind of hawkish rhetoric and does something very different.
Thank God he did, or we might all be dead now, right?
That's true.
Yeah. Tell me about the pressure that he received to respond with significant military force to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, when we study the Cuban Missile Crisis, we usually start the story in the middle of October of 1962, when Kennedy, in a dramatic moment, discovers these CIA photos of Soviet missiles in Cuba. But what I learned as I was writing this is that the debate over Cuba started in the summer of 62. Why? Because Republicans were arguing that Kennedy was ignoring evidence that the Soviets were putting weapons in Cuba. And they were making this on the Senate floor. They were saying this in the media. And he was under pressure from Republicans to be more hawkish on Cuba. Republicans make this the central theme of the midterm campaigns. So when there is discovery that it's true, he's under intense pressure, not just from military officials, but from Republicans, to take a more hawkish stand. Many Democrats are privately telling him, like Mike Mansfield, the Senate Majority Leader, that Democrats are nervous. He's reluctant to be hawkish enough. And in the end, though, what you see is Kennedy says no. He decides military force is too dangerous. It would open up a nuclear war, and he enters into the famous negotiations at the end with the Soviet Union. But it's military pressure and it's political pressure that we often kind of push aside in our historical memories that was very much what Kennedy was facing.
Right. Let's go next. Marilyn, thanks for your call. Jim from Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. I definitely will look at the author's book. It sounds quite comprehensive in terms of modern terms. But my basic question is, does the guest think that we have turned the vision of the Founding Fathers upside down, and maybe reference point would definitely be at the point of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, even though I'm not a person who lives literally by the Bible, most of us are familiar with that phrase, he who lives by the sword will also die by it, and now we're in a situation where we are doing more than 50% of the entire world's military spending at the expense of the American taxpayer.
This too, again, is an ongoing concern that I found. I mean, the question of, how big should government be in fighting in our national security operations, and what the cost is of expanding government, the constitutional cost in terms of civil liberties, the budgetary cost in terms of us spending on that rather than other issues, and the constitutional cost with issues like congressional power. Are we getting too far away from where this country started? I don't have a specific answer in terms of a yes or no, but I do think there are elements of that argument which are extremely important and continually come up during every phase of our national security history. And it's one where I think, again, it's very difficult to move very far back from where we are today. I do think, the national security system is put into place, it expands, and it's politically very hard to retrench. And Obama has discovered this, I think, very quickly. The national security system looks very much like it did under George Bush.
Definitely. How long is it sustainable? That's really the question.
That is the question, and the question, again, that many fear is that in the end, this is what Eisenhower used to say, that in the end, some of the things we do could subvert the very kind of political system that we want to protect.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim, very much for the call. Let's just talk, because I'm interested in your response to the Scott Brown victory in Massachusetts. I was watching news last night and I haven't seen a lot of the ads in Massachusetts. I'm wondering if this issue of Republicans will keep you safe, watch out if it's Democrats because they won't, keeps playing on, and whether or not it was a significant factor, do you think, Professor Zelizar, in Brown's victory, because he used it on television ads in Massachusetts?
I think ever since, the Republicans have been making the argument since Obama took office. They've brought this up immediately, kind of the national security card, so to speak, and Richard Cheney has been at the forefront of making the argument, our former vice president. And I do think since the Christmas bombing effort and the response, this kind of slow response, there was an acceleration of Republican attacks. Republicans like to make this attack when they're out of power. It's instinctive to go back to this issue. Again, it dates really back to the Cold War. It's nothing new, although we don't always have former vice presidents leading the charge. It might have been part of what happened. I think Massachusetts, in the end, was a mix of, you know, poor campaign by the Democrat, voter frustration over the economy. But I would suspect that, you know, some of the national security stuff, at least at a vague level, is going to be at play, and it will certainly be at play in 2010. I don't think President Obama, you know, who campaigned on a very clear vision of what he wanted to change, has articulated what he's for. And then when these crises emerge, he's been susceptible to some of these Republican attacks, and my guess is they'll play out in local electorates like Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. And I guess some of the complaints were bringing Guantanamo prisoners to federal court in New York.
And that was a huge one, where the, you know, politics of this issue flared, you know, right up front, both with bringing them to court and closing Guantanamo. If you remember when he first announces that, there's a huge blowback to Democrats. They're feeling pressure as Republicans are saying, you're going to put terrorists in our backyard. Same things that happened when the court date was announced, or the court treatment was announced. And I think, you know, he hasn't closed Guantanamo, and part of it is, you know, the politics has not been orchestrated as well as he hoped, and I don't think all Democrats are on board with this at this point.
We go next to Daryl from Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen and Professor Zelzer. I just had a couple comments.
Sure.
It seems that America as a country invests so much into our past, which is war, and so little into our future, which is health care, education, and jobs for people. Also, it looks like, from watching TV, war is so hard and costly to make, you know, compared to peace, and we do a lot wrong to expect things to be all right. It's like we are a snake eating its own tail. Is that just the American way now?
Yeah, I think it's been, you know, some of that's been the American way for a while. For me, one of the most haunting, you know, moments to study is always the entrance or expansion of the Vietnam War under Lyndon Johnson, to get back to that. And one of the remarkable things we've learned through the presidential tapes was Johnson was aware of the trade-off that you just mentioned. Privately, when speaking with people like Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, senior conservative, who was telling him Vietnam doesn't matter to the Cold War, and Vietnam is going to be, you know, a pit where we're going to send our people, our money, and we're not going to get anything from it. Johnson understands that, and he's telling Richard Russell, I know that, and he's aware of what this could cost him politically and his domestic vision. But in the end, you know, his political fears of withdrawing are much greater than his very keen sense of what this war could bring to the nation. And I think we see that play out very often. Again, there's some moments when presidents act differently. JFK was one example. You know, Reagan, in his last 2 years, acts in ways that infuriate conservatives when he finally does what he said Republicans should never do. He had spent his career saying, don't negotiate with communists, and he does. But too often, I think presidents can't avoid those fears, and they act accordingly.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. You are welcome to join our conversation. Our guest this hour is Professor Julian Zelizer. He's joined us many times. This time, it's for his book, which is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. And it is a very, very comprehensive look at how, well, domestic policies have played in the national security crises in the past half century. It looks at the important issues of, well, he says there are four central concerns that have shaped national security during those past 60 years, the balance between congressional and executive power, the partisan advantage on national security, the size of government the nation is willing to tolerate in the pursuit of peace and security, and the benefits of a unilateral as opposed to a multilateral approach to to foreign relations. So it has really in-depth look. He's a historian, so it's in-depth looks at the Truman administration. And actually, it goes. He spends a lot of time on Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and McKinley. Even mentions George Washington, FDR, Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, all of the presidential administrations during the last 60 years. So we'll take more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls. Wayne is next from Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Morning, Wayne.
Go Brett.
Oh, Wayne, let's not get into that argument.
Anyway, I've enjoyed your professor as a guest very much. He's a pretty sharp guy. I would like to He did bring up Massachusetts, so I'd like to ask him a couple quick questions, and if he thinks I'm wrong, then he's probably right. But it seemed to me, in that election, the independents went strongly for Scott Brown. And I know there were different numbers coming out, but the percentage I heard, sir, was that 65% of the independents that typically, that almost all, voted for President Obama voted for Scott Brown, and I found that to be interesting. And also I found interesting was that 25% of the registered Democrats went to Scott Brown. And that's pretty amazing to me. I'd kind of look at that as kind of a tsunami in epic proportions in politics. But I don't know. At the exit polling in heavily independent precincts, the folks said they just weren't happy in the direction the country was going, and I'd like your perspective, sir.
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting thing in some of the polling is that many people who voted for Brown support health care reform, and there's these contradictory messages in what's coming out with some of the polls, but I think, you know, as we can, you always have to be careful interpreting a local special election, especially one like this, into national trends and what's going to happen in other states going into 2010. But clearly, and you could see the White House has a sense of this, there is some unhappiness or uncertainty about what the administration is doing, what it's about, and its leadership. I think that's where you could see vaguely what voters are responding to. And I do think, you know, this president has been a bit elusive. I think he has been moving based on what happens rather than trying to shape events himself. And when you're like that, it's easy for your opposition to open up attacks, all kinds of charges against you. I do think it was telling that President Obama went to Massachusetts to support Coakley, and he was very clear to voters that, you know, this is central to our success, to have a Democrat in this seat. And in the end, that wasn't enough to move people, even the people you mentioned in the polls. So I do think there's a leadership question that has emerged, even though he remains popular. And I do think there are signs that will be troubling in that electorate, although I would be hesitant yet to translate that nationally.
Mm-hmm. And let's move to foreign policy and national security issues with him as well. You write about and have for CNN.com about his decisions in Afghanistan that could really bog him down in many ways, and it hasn't been going very well since, well, not for a long time, but since the troop increase. There more and more Americans are being killed and injured. Is this issue that he believes is very much tied to national security one that could essentially do him in terms of money, in terms of no success?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he, in his comments, separated this from Vietnam. He made a speech where he, you know, took issue
right.
for people who make the comparison to Johnson going into Vietnam and him accelerating the war in Afghanistan. And I think, you know, he's off there. You know, Vietnam was not what it became in 1964, in 1965. It was still a much smaller operation than it would be by 1968. But if you kind of read through the internal debates that went through the White House in 1964, and you see how the messy terrain in which the U.S. was fighting made it hard to have any kind of decisive victory, and you see see how, you know, accelerating the troops actually did nothing to stop attacks on the president from Republicans. You could see all kinds of similarities in what can happen here. Now, again, Afghanistan might not turn into Vietnam, and it might be a shorter operation, but there are certainly a lot of similarities. And one other is that, you know, Johnson, many advisors told him, don't do this. And he did it anyway. And I think right now we know that that Obama received similar advice, including from
yes.
the vice president, and didn't take it. So there are comparisons. We don't know how it'll turn out, but I do think, you know, this could be a very defining decision for him. And it's also, I mean, the Christmas bombing raised an interesting issue of homeland security, which is a place Republicans are not as strong on in some ways. I mean, there are arguments that, you know, the Republicans weren't willing to invest in stuff like transportation security as much as some Democrats wanted. But that's not where President Obama has really invested now his political capital. It's in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Ronald Reagan for a moment. I think that most people who were alive during that time and those who know about Ronald Reagan in some detail would say that that he was very strong on national security. It was a conservative mandate. You have written in your piece on Ronald Reagan that in terms of national security, the election of 1980 was not a conservative mandate.
No, that's one of the things. I have a chapter on Reagan's first few years, and one of the things Reagan learns is Reagan, who was a hawk his whole career, who argued, you know, that things like détente, negotiations with the Soviet Union, which took place in the 70s, were bad and dangerous for the country, and that Soviet Union could not be trusted. You know, he comes in, he does push for increased spending, Ronald Reagan, in 1981 and 82 on defense. He's very hawkish in his rhetoric, calling the Soviets an evil empire. But he learns that the country is not necessarily, you know, a Rambo country. There is no support for restoring the draft. There's very little public support for his call for intervention in Central America. House Democrats passed the famous Bolin Amendments, which put restrictions on the president. The nuclear freeze movement, which calls for freeze in the production of nuclear weapons, is a very vibrant movement in the 1980s, much more than we remember. International movement that draws millions to some of its rallies. And there's popular culture things like The Day After, a movie about nuclear war, that you know, a lot of the public is watching. And Reagan, in the end, realizes that there's going to be limits to that hawkish agenda. And he scales back in terms of what he's going to do. And again, famously, he ends his presidency not through war, not through militarism, but instead by taking an opportunity to negotiate an arms agreement with Mikhail Gorbachev.
Yeah. Lines are open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. Carl from Madison is next. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Kathleen and Professor Salazar. Professor, my memory is just a memory. And my general question involves the extent to which ideology corrupts intelligence and then intelligence shapes policy or the strategy. And specifically, I was wondering if you could review a little bit. It was during this situation in particular. I believe George Bush was the director of the CIA, and it was about 1976. And somehow there was a lot of pressure put on the CIA to rethink some intelligence reports that they had assembled about the strength of the Soviet Union. There was this talk about a red team and a blue team and how each was trying to outdo the other one as far as the heinousness of the Soviet Union and what they were capable of doing. And what I was thinking was this, how was that forced on the CIA? And is it true that that really did affect our view of the Soviet Union for 15 years afterwards?
There is a famous independent review of CIA intelligence that takes place in right after really the 1976 election. It's called Team B, and many of the people on it and who support it are people we would today call neoconservatives. They were many Democrats who thought, you know, détente under Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford had been the wrong direction. They argued that both Democrats and Republicans were trusting the Soviet Union too much, and they argued that the CIA had underestimated Soviet military strength.
and they issue a very famous report, yes, that becomes a rallying cry that the Soviets were advancing in intercontinental missiles and other kinds of weapon systems, and the Soviet Union were really intent on obtaining mutual military superiority rather than adhering to the concept of mutual assured destruction, where both sides could blow each other up, so no one was going to take the first move. And that report is politically explosive. It becomes a key mechanism to attack what moderates had been doing in foreign policy during the 1970s, becomes a way to attack the whole concept of détente, and it becomes a way to push for increased military spending, which Reagan will undertake in his first few years. One last thing is, following that Team B study, a group called the Committee on the Present Danger forms, which includes people like Eugene Rostow and Richard Pearl and Gene Kirkpatrick, and they will use that report to continue to build pressure for intelligence reform, for military spending, and to fight against any idea that détente could be safe for this country.
I suppose it's too much to ask that somehow the intelligence services be given more of a free hand and independence, I suppose, right?
Well, some want that, others don't want it. In the end, intelligence is going to be interpreted by politicians, both in the executive branch and Congress. There's nothing to do about that. I think in some ways we have to accept that politics and national security policy always mix. And we need politicians who will, be the best at handling and balancing those two forces. There is evidence under the Bush administration that wasn't always balanced very well, and the politics overtook the intelligence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. Let's talk a little bit about the Bush administration, and please tell me how it came to be that we had near unanimity among Democrats and Republicans, great sorrow in this country, outpouring of sympathy from people all over the world after the September 11th attacks. And then we wind up with a policy where we're going to war with a country based on totally faulty intelligence, and everybody kind of goes along with it, and we're mired down there how many years later now. How did that happen?
I think the two are related, meaning one of the things when you review, I have a chapter on 9/11 and the weeks and months that followed, and one of the remarkable things is just how quickly all those promises of bipartisanship ended. Literally within a few months, both parties are fighting with each other. There's certain issues like airline security, which become partisan fodder. Democrats want government workers, unionized workers, to handle security. Republicans want to contract with private corporations, and they're fighting by the end of the year over this kind of issue, not far after 9/11. And so the parties are, really at each other very quickly. And I think when we get to the resolution for the war in Iraq, neither side really wants to give ground. And I think many Democrats are nervous that if they don't vote for that, they will be susceptible to Republican attacks, that they're weak on defense, the attacks that were being made regularly. There's a lot of debate before that resolution. We forget a lot of debate with senators openly questioning whether Iraq was worth it, with the media questioning, in fact, whether there was weapons of mass destruction, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But in the end, they ignore that. And I think part of it was we were in such a heated political atmosphere after 9/11 that the political strategy of voting against that seemed suicidal for many Democrats.
And look at where we are so many years later.
We're still there. And again, to go back to Vietnam, many Democrats voted for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964, not because there was some Cold War consensus or belief that Vietnam was so critical. Many Democrats were saying privately they were nervous about giving the president so much power. They were not clear why we had to do anything in Vietnam, but many do it because William Fulbright, a senator from Arkansas, goes to senators in 64 and says, if we don't do this, President Johnson will be vulnerable in the election against Barry Goldwater, and many Democrats will in the congressional elections, and we have to do this for political reasons. A few years later, Fulbright would write in his book, it was one of his biggest mistakes, and he let the politics overtake what many Democrats knew was not a great decision, and you could argue some Democrats feel the same way today.
Hmm. And in the minute we have left, we haven't even mentioned President Bill Clinton. How did he respond? I know your book deals with some of this, to what is traditionally an attack on Democrats for being too weak on defense?
He, two ways. One is he uses military force many times. He tries to kind of overcome that image. He uses it in Bosnia, Kosovo. He uses it in Iraq several times and bombs al-Qaeda targets. And here at home, following Oklahoma City, a terrible terrorist act, the bombing of a federal building, he pushes for a huge expansion of domestic national security programs, which Republicans oppose in Congress and subvert many of them. But he is like Democrats in the late 50s with the missile gap argument, tries to recover lost ground from the Republican Party on this being weak on defense issue, and offers a new kind of Democratic centrist national security agenda.
Mm. Well, the book is terrific. Thank you so much for being with us, as always, Professor Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
The book is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's also the author of On Capitol Hill and Taxing America, winner of the Organization of American Historians Ellis Hawley Prize, as well as several edited books. He contributes regularly to CNN.com and to many other prominent papers, newspapers, and magazines in this country, and joins us quite frequently for All Things Political on Mondays at 9. Thanks to Mimi Notstein for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for helping with production and doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, as always, everybody, for your calls. I'll be with you again on Monday morning for All Things Political. This is the Ideas Network.